This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. Today, we're going to spend some time in Victoria a little later this hour after the news headlines at 12:30. Taking a look at the fire and the damage that's been done, with authorities saying that more than 350 structures have been destroyed and 1,000 agricultural properties impacted by those Victorian fires. So we'll take a look at that and then head to Queensland to look at the stock losses in the floodwaters in that state and the assistance that's on its way to help those farming communities across both of those states. We'll also head to Mouchay for the results of the sheep market just before the news at 1 o'clock. And shortly we'll catch up with a fisherman from Geraldton who chained his boat to a gate preventing government officers from leaving the local wharf as a protest against the government's demersal fishing ban. We'll hear from him shortly here on the Country Hour. 12:06. We'll start with the grains industry today, as the CEO of WA Farmers wants the state government to follow through on its proposal to buy back the state's freight rail network. A year ago, the Transport Minister, Rita Saffioti, said the government would enter negotiations to reverse the privatisation of the network, which was sold off by the Court government in 2000 under a 49-year lease. It's currently being operated by Brookfield, now ARC Infrastructure. Trevor Whittington says the state is now on track to deliver a record grain harvest of 26.5 million tonnes, or maybe even more. And it's really time to get serious about getting more grain on rail and more trucks off WA roads.
It's a literally rolling a train wreck, which has been happening and building for 25 years since the Court government, who I worked for back in the day, sold the old West Rail 5,500 kilometres of rail, country rail, to foreign owners, thinking that they would invest and upgrade the system. And it's been an utter failure, and we're now paying for it.
How are we paying
for
it, Trevor?
So back in the glory days, back then when we had a lot more sheep running around the place, we were producing 10, 12, 14 million tonnes on a good year worth of grain. This year we've just cracked 26 million tonnes. We're heading towards 30 plus million, and the rail network can't handle probably more than 10 million tonnes. So every million tonnes is 10,000 more truck movements. And we're not talking small trucks. We're talking the big B doubles, the 60 tonnes, or the pocket road trains, 80 tonnes, all the triples that we're seeing on the roads.
And obviously that adds to the wear and tear of the roads, obviously adds to the traffic and I guess more hazards for motorists.
Yeah, indeed. A big truck like that is 100 times more damaging to country roads, as your listeners will note when they go on holiday and head down south or up north. The side of the roads are getting hammered, and that is the direct response of more trucks, more big wheels doing more kilometres, and it's just going to get worse. So, look, credit to the state government. A Labor government has flown the kite of taking back the lease on that rail, which is not due to finish for another till 2047, so another 26 years or something, and starting the long, expensive process of reinvesting. We welcome that. That announcement was this time last year, 12 months ago, just before the state election. And we're still waiting to see what's going to happen.
I mean, from what, has there been any progress in that regard, that negotiation to bring the freight rail network back into public hands?
Why would you announce it if you're going to, you know, it's a multi-billion dollar negotiation. Why would you announce that you're going to buy something before just quietly, you know, opening the conversation? So that makes it a bit suspicious that it was political. But look, it seemed to take 8 months, August last year, before they engaged some consultants to do some work. So that doesn't sort of inspire confidence that they are in any great rush. And it is a government that can make decisions really fast. They don't need a lot of reports to, you know, do racetracks in the city or to expand Metronet or replace the bridge up at, you know, Fitzroy Crossing. That was all done within 12 months. So we know they can move rapidly if they want to, but this one looks suspiciously like it might be a political exercise rather than a real exercise.
Because they did talk, they did say that they would have a business case, get a business case into whether it would be worth bringing it back into public hands. And as you make the point, there's been other things like a racetrack where there was no business case, but I guess we're talking about a potentially multi-billion dollar deal here. My suspicion is the cost is probably what would put them off.
Well, you know, they haven't helped themselves by flagging it in the media in advance. So, of course, Brookfield, which is an American-Canadian company who own, they love monopoly assets. They've got ports and rail lines and airports around the world, which they are really good at sweating, which means that they extract every last cent by investing minimal back, which is exactly what's been happening here. And it's just going to get worse. There's no incentive for them to put a dollar into it for the remainder of that lease. And so if the government's serious about it, you would have thought after, you know, 9 years or 8 years then in power, they would have had all the Treasury and Department of Finance modelling done. They would know all the costs and impact, and they would have ploughed ahead to get serious about it. Now, Brookfield has flown a kite of, you know, it's worth $15 billion, only paid $600 or $700 million for it for the 49-year lease. And if the government was serious, they could really put the pressure on them to perform to the detail of the lease, which no one's ever seen, which is a concern. But look, the real issue is for Western Australians, seeing every million tonnes of grain, another 10,000 truck movements, that's out and back on the road. And, you know, farmers will, as we'll see, elect to use trucks if there is no rail, efficient rail system to use.
Would farmers prefer to put more of their produce on rail?
Yeah, look, we, like everyone else, it's hard to find truck drivers, particularly ones with the license to drive the really big trucks. And it's a lot easier to run from the paddock into your local CBH bin than it is to run through to Esperance, Albany, Geraldton or Kwinana. And you know, farmers got plenty of other things to do rather than sit on trucks. But, you know, cheapest form, paddock to port, is what they prefer. And the most efficient way, cheapest historically, has been rail.
CEO of WA Farmers, Trevor Whittington, speaking to Nadia Mitsopoulos. A state government spokesperson says negotiations to bring the state's freight rail network back into public hands are ongoing. And due to the commercial nature of these negotiations, it wouldn't be appropriate to comment further at this stage. The government is committed to bringing the state's freight rail network back into public hands. The demands on the state's freight rail network have grown significantly, and the government wants to make sure that it's moving as much by rail to and from our ports as possible. And it also means less trucks on the roads, which is something local communities are always calling for. The spokesperson says this is not an easy process, but necessary to support future job creation and the ongoing prosperity of our state. What do you think? Is this ever going to happen? This freight rail network back in public hands, what might it cost? Is it worth the money? Would you be happy to see taxpayer money spent like that? Let me know. 0448 922 604. 14 past 12.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
A Geraldton fisherman has chained his boat to a gate, preventing government officers from leaving the local wharf as a protest against the state government's demersal fishing ban. John Hyam runs a managed shark fishery, but his licence also allows him to catch other fish like jewfish and pink snapper. And as a result of that, his business is a casualty of the fishing ban. He says after receiving a letter offering $6,000 compensation, he wanted to make some noise.
Feels like I just got kicked in the guts. Yeah, the only way I can make some sort of noise is do what I did. took me boat down to the department, chained it up against their gate, and if I can't go to work, why should they be allowed to go to work? It's not fair.
John, fishers have been talking publicly about the impact that this demersal ban is having on their business and their livelihoods. What kind of an impact is it having on yourself?
Mentally strained, feel worthless, no money coming in, thinking about selling the house. If I can't get another job, we're going to have to sell that. And then, yeah, it's not a good way.
For people that don't know, can you tell us a little bit about your business so people can have a bit more understanding about how this ban impacts you in particular?
Well, basically, I'm a very tiny little commercial shark fishing boat. My boat's 4.2 metres long. I run 300 metres of shark net. In the last 14 months, I've caught one jewfish, four snapper, and one balchin. I only target shark. That's all I target. So my boat's got a 5 mile. It can't go out any further than 5 mile. So that restricts me, as it already does, in even trying to target any sort of scale fish. So, yeah, I go out there, set the net, pull the net next morning, fill it on that day, and then go sell direct to the public in down at BCF car park in my little fish trailer van.
Yeah, and so now with this ban coming into play, what kind of an impact would that have on yourself?
I don't know. It still hasn't really sunk in, but still, at the end of the day, you know, what else? I can't do any more. Nothing more I can do. I can just keep trying to look for jobs. I'm not qualified for anything else. I don't have a trade. I don't have a truck driving license.
And, John, in terms of, I guess, your sort of life plan, is this business that you and your wife run, is this what you thought was going to prop you up for the rest of your life and set you up for retirement?
Absolutely. That's why I brought this license. It's under a MFL, Managed Fishing License. It's a managed fishery. It's been managed. And how can they just discard the whole managed fishery? It's been managed. Like, how can they do that? You know, where has it gone wrong? I've done all the right things. I've been doing my reporting and all that sort of stuff. All the commercial fishermen have to do that. So how has it gone to this stage?
Geraldton shark fisher John Higham speaking to Piper Duffy about the state government's ban on demersal fishing and the financial toll it's going to take on his business. This on the text with an attached sign from the Coles supermarket, and it says, this is a sign you can see at your local Coles store. Already the ban has affected fish supplies with no local fresh fish and mainly imported fish. Fish supplies won't be any different after the ban ends because there'll be no professional fishermen to catch the fish. You want to be part of the conversation? It's easy. Text through 0448 922 604. 18 past 12. You're listening to the Country Hour. Let's move to the southwest of the state now, where the WA government has awarded a contract aimed at tackling the growing feral animal problems in the region. The Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions has created a panel of contractors for feral animal control in the Warren region. It's going to target feral pigs in particular, but also other pest species on land managed by the department. The department's Manjima Regional Lead for Conservation, Peter Bamus, says the pigs are causing a lot of damage to the natural environment and farmland.
Being a declared pest and introduced animal, the main problem with them has been the impacts on the environment, on conservation values, on DBCA estate, and I suppose the offset of that as well, potential impacts on agricultural land that's adjacent to our lands. So as far as the physical environment and its impact to native species, so and introduction of weeds, so like Phytophthorus innomomi, Jarrah dieback, spreading of that through there, liking to get in the mud and spread that when they move through the landscape. They also damage peatlands, which are sensitive areas, and wetlands. They like the water areas and the low-lying muddy areas, so certainly damage to our wetlands, which are sensitive areas, and habitat alteration, which can also cause introduction of secondary predators such as foxes and cats that can go in and have bigger impact on our native species.
How has this, the impact or the damage, evolved over the recent years? Has there been an increase?
Yeah, I suppose they've been introduced. So as the numbers have built over the years, the impacts are bigger. So we're trying to maintain levels that we can manage for the species to not have too severe impacts, and also not increase in numbers. And then in the future, you know, ideally would be look at eradication if possible. But it certainly need to keep on top of the populations to minimise impact on, particularly on our conservation values on DBCA land.
Yeah, yeah. And tell me about this tender that's been awarded for a new feral animal control contract. What is it actually designed to do and what will it do?
The tender went out there to find suitable contractors as such to manage the pig problem for us. So the tender was put out and we, there's successful applicants, I guess, and we can call upon them when there's a pig problem to come and do work on our lands on our behalf due to our in-house resources might not be available. So they're out there helping with the problem.
I mean, feral pigs probably don't respect boundaries. How is DBCA coordinating control on national parks and what is happening on neighbouring private land?
With our program, we encourage people to report, members of the public, to our local offices of pig activity and also with neighbours as in farmers. So if people report a problem, particularly farmers, that they might be coming from our estate into farmland and impacting on their agricultural business, we will work together with them to help eradicate the problem. And we will use those contract groups to also liaise and establish pig traps to hopefully remove them from the areas. But it's normally from sightings or signs that we see where the animals are, and then we'll take action to try and remove them from those areas, particularly next to private property and in areas where conservation values are high.
And the contract is worth up to almost $500,000 over several years. Is that enough to make a real dent in pig numbers in this region?
Well, hopefully it's money in the right direction. So, you know, money becomes available through grants and mainly through grants and other agencies that we do work through the Southwest NRM. We get work through other agencies to help with this. So we can use as much as we can, but hopefully it'll make a dent and at least maintain populations.
Peter Bemis from DBCA speaking to Rachel Boothman, 23 past 12. Well, pigs aren't the only trouble across Western Australia and much of the country. The Centre for Invasive Species Solutions says a new biocontrol agent needs to be developed every 10 years to effectively control rabbit numbers across Australia. Heidi Kleinert is the Centre's National Rabbit Management Coordinator. She says ideal seasonal conditions have seen rabbit numbers boom.
Rabbits currently are across two-thirds of Australia and they're our fastest colonising mammal. Female rabbits can breed any time of year if there's sufficient feed available, and the main breeding season is really determined by rainfall and the early growth of high-protein plants. So we see this boom and bust cycle right across Australia.
So is that, explain why we're in a bit of a boom right now then?
Yeah, so if we've had a wet spring or summer, there's been plenty of growth or feed available for rabbits, which triggers the breeding cycle.
And what sort of numbers are we talking?
Yeah, so at the moment we don't have the exact number of rabbits, but because they're so mobile, but we do know that we anticipate that there's about 200 million rabbits across Australia. And they, when they are breeding and they have great conditions, they can breed every 28 days.
Hence the saying, breeding like rabbits, right?
Correct, yeah.
So they are breeding in huge numbers. What do we do then? We've had viruses, haven't we, in the past to reduce the population. What are we doing at the moment?
Yeah, so we've got traditional methods such as baiting, ripping and fumigation, but we also have biocontrol such as the Khaleesi virus. So biocontrol has enormous benefits as the virus is designed to target the rabbits. It can spread across the country by itself and drastically reduce those number of rabbits that are impacting agriculture and environment.
So what do you want done more though? You obviously think at the moment if they're getting to these sorts of numbers that we need to be doing more.
Yeah. So what I'd like to see is a new biocontrol agent developed every 10 years to help counter the genetic resistance that builds up in rabbits over time. And our policy challenge is that Australia doesn't have a national funding model that enables long-term investment in biocontrol, despite it being such a good investment.
All right. And just, I mean, it's a bit of the obvious question, I know, but what is the danger that they are posing? Why is this so important that we do try to keep on top of it?
So we know that it costs agriculture over $200 million in lost agriculture production each year, but they also endanger 300 at-risk plants and animals. They also impact our community assets. So think about our parks, our gardens, our sporting facilities, even our cemeteries, and they can also impact sacred cultural places for our First Nations people.
Heidi Kleinert, she's from the Centre for Invasive Species Solutions. She was speaking to Mark Gibson. 26 past 12. Let's get to some of your texts now. Some support for Geraldton fisherman John Hyman, who chained his boat to a gate preventing government officers from leaving the local wharf as a protest against the state government's demersal fishing ban. This from Tyson. Great stuff, John. We need to do more stuff like that to get through to this ignorant, arrogant Labor government. And also some thoughts on what you heard from CEO of WA Farmers, Trevor Whittington. He's wanting the state government to follow through on its proposal to buy back the state's freight rail network and get more grain on rail rather than more grain on trucks. This on the text from Jim, who says, if Brookfield or ARC are being manipulative with the sale or buyback, maybe as an immediate solution leading into the long-term investment, just lease the rail track and use it to get trucks off the road. While time goes by until the lease runs out in 2047, manage the damage, imagine the damage to roads if rail is used. This too from John Hassell. He says, very hard for rail to compete on a least cost pathway when ARC is gouging growers at least three times the access cost in WA as the eastern states. And David says, trucks off the road, it's never going to happen. Trucks still have to cart it into CBH. What about all the lime fertiliser liquid and general freight that has to go by road? Just build the roads better, says David. 28 past 12, just before we get to the news headlines, a fruit grower in Carnarvon, 900 kilometres north of Perth, has harvested a huge mango. Gascoyne River plantation owner Wayne Whitcroft says the mango weighed over a kilogram and was about the size of a bowling ball or a child's head. He says ideal conditions have produced larger than expected stone fruit this season.
Just a bit unusual because it had ripened quite a bit earlier. There's bigger ones there, but that one was just ripe hanging there.
So this isn't the first of the monster mangoes. This is one of potentially a bit of a crop of big mangoes.
There's a lot of big number eights, yeah, just sort of hanging everywhere. This year, maybe with our fertiliser regime, we've just got a lot better bigger crop.
And looking at the photo of the mango, it looks about the size of a head. I mean, how big would you say it is? How heavy was it, do you think?
Well, it's probably been devoured now, so it was, well over a kilo.
So a kilo mango, that's huge. And as you said, you think you might have been doing the right thing with the fertiliser, but how does a mango get that big? What else might contribute to it?
It's probably the weather conditions, watering, and it's an R2E2, and sometimes they are quite big.
So it's the type of mango in any case and just the right circumstances.
Right conditions, yeah.
What's happened with the mango? What's the plans with it? Is it going to be eaten, made into daiquiris?
We can't find it. So I'd say the kids have cut it up already.
Oh, no. Well, if it is lost, I can't imagine it would be too hard to find.
It's probably got a very big seed in it.
If you were to plant that seed, I mean, does that mean that the future of mangoes, we're going to have 1 kilo mangoes as a standard, or?
I think that sort of thing for Chinese New Year and that type of thing is quite advantageous for sure.
Gascoyne River plantation owner Wayne Whitcroft telling Kimberly Putland all about that big mango. Around about 1 kilo it weighed, but it's gone missing, and he's putting the blame on the kids, which is probably right. 12:30 here on the Country Hour. Jonathan Beale is here. He's got the news headlines for you.
Thanks, Belinda. Police are responding to reports of a man armed with a firearm south of Perth. Police say they have deployed significant resources to Pinjarra in the Peel region. Anyone in the vicinity of the incident is being asked to follow the instructions of police. Police say further information will be provided as it becomes available. The Premier says the government is working hard to strengthen laws to stop the sale of illegal tobacco products in the state. Roger Cook says new legislation is in the advanced stages of being drafted and will be introduced into Parliament this year. Yesterday, the opposition accused the government of not making the issue a priority. Mr. Cook says the required legislation is complicated and will take time to put in place. And the Albanese government is seeking more information after the US president announced Washington would impose 25% tariffs on any country doing business with Iran. Donald Trump has made the announcement on social media, saying the change is effective immediately. Australia and Iran have an ongoing trade relationship with wheat among Australia's key exports, along with meat and fish. More news, Belinda, at 1 o'clock.
Thank you for that update, Jonathan. 28-1 here on the Country Hour. We're going to spend a little bit of time in the eastern states between now and the news at 1. We'll call into Victoria. Just devastating, the impact of those fires that we've seen, those images, the video that's coming through. We're going to have a look at some of the property damage to, well, farmland, properties, and just the cleanup process, that assessment and what to do from this point on. And also into Queensland with the flood situation and the stock losses going on there. And then catch up with Blaze Aid just to look at the work they're doing to help those farming communities across both of those states. As they always do. And off to Mouche for the results of the sheep market just before the news at 1. This is the Country on the ABC, right across WA and streaming live on the ABC Listen app. We are off to the Bureau of Meteorology now. Joey Rawson is here today. Joey, let's start with a look across the Southwest Land Division.
Yeah, hi, Belinda. We do have some cloud through the southwest and southern parts of the Southwest Land Division. There's been some showers around, but a lot of that shower activity will contract to the coast during sort of the afternoon and evening, and also extend along the south coast. Those showers are more around the southwest and Albany coast, but they will extend towards the Esperance coast as the afternoon wears on. And then we don't have a lot for the Southwest Land Division until we get to Thursday when we have the next West Coast trough, which is going to start pulling some thunderstorms down from the north. So those thunderstorms are expected to be dragged from the north to reach somewhere around York, Cunderdin. It will be inland from the west coast. We won't expect much rain out of those thunderstorms on Thursday, but there could be something develop, and the most we could get would probably be around 5 to 10 millimetres. And on Friday, those storms will keep getting dragged further south, so they'll they'll reach the south coast on Friday, getting places like Albany and Esperance, and remain along the south coast on a Saturday as that trough starts progressing to the east. So in the short term, not a lot, but then something certainly happening as that trough drags those storms down, Belinda.
Let's move into northern and eastern parts of the state. It looks like there's been some more rain, particularly across the Kimberley, in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, and I'll get to those figures in a sec. Is that set to continue?
Yeah, definitely. So this, we're going to have storms through the Kimberley, Pilbara, northern interior for a number of days, pretty seasonal type storms. However, the storms over the Pilbara and southwest Kimberley, there's not a lot of wind driving them. So if you do get a storm, the storm will stay over you for some time, which will then bring some pretty decent rainfall. So there's a potential of maybe 40 to 60 millimetres of rain if you do get a storm over you. And we've seen that at Carrageenie as well as Mandorah through the last 24 hours. So that will continue most likely for today, tomorrow. But once we get to Friday and Saturday, the winds will start pushing those storms a bit quicker. So the rain will be more around that 30 to 50 millimetre mark. And then what we've got coming sort of later in the weekend into the early part of next week, it's just a bit of a watch point that we've got a system that's tracking across from Queensland, which may develop into a tropical cyclone. But it's only a low chance at this stage, so just a watch point, Belinda.
All right, thank you for going through those details, Joey. 24 to 1. As we were just discussing, most of the rain in the Kimberley in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, checking 5 millimetres on over in northern and eastern forecast districts firstly. In the Kimberley, Country Downs 10, Curtin Aero 58, Signet Bay 27, Derby Aero 15. Diggers Rest 44, Doongan 20, Allen Bray 7, Faraway Bay 29, Fitzroy Crossing Aero 10, Fossil Downs 18, Gibb River 33, Kachana 12, Kununurra Checkpoint 8, Kununurra 8 also. Lansdowne 9, Leopold Downs 15, Lombardina Aero 23, Mandorah 30, Marion Downs 4, Mount Amherst 8, Mount Barnett 21, Mount House Airstrip 14, Old Mornington Homestead had 25, Parry Creek Farm 6, Siddons Creek 13, Theta 31, Trouton Island 36, Truscott 37, Wijana Gorge 8, Yampi Sound 26, and Yumbu had 7. In the Pilbara, Carrageenie North 61, Newman Aero 5, Parabadoo Aero had 10, and then in the Gascoyne, Mount Vernon 5. And in the Southwest Land Division, just one recording over 5 millimetres, and that was in the southern coastal region at many peaks with 5 mils in the gauge. 22 to 1. To Victoria now, where authorities say more than 350 structures have been destroyed and 1,000 agricultural properties impacted by the Victorian fires. Multiple fires continue to burn out of control across the state, but this morning all emergency warnings had been downgraded to watch and axe. Trevor Peeler is the manager of the Harcourt Cooperative Cool Stores at Harcourt in central Victoria. Those cool stores have now gone, wiped out by fire in a matter of minutes.
The Harcourt Cooperative Cool Stores virtually took the brunt of a fairly large firestorm that they were caught really in the middle of it. And it all happened that quickly because it was such a hot, windy day. No one was even aware the fire was down there. It got there that quickly. It was first set up in 1917 for the local apple growers. So it's got a very long history in this district. A lot of the older people relate to the Harcourt Cool Stores in a fairly passionate way.
Trevor, just explain what role the Cool Store actually played, what businesses it serviced, and just how important it was.
It's become very important to local businesses, sort of far and wide. We're because there's not as many apples grown in Harcourt now, it's become a bit of a hub for wine storage and craft brewing beers, that type of thing, because there's no place quite like us in central Victoria. We can, we've got good refrigeration, or I should say we had good refrigeration and specialised cool rooms.
Trevor, I'm sure this is hard to talk about, but what was it like when you got to the cool store after the fire and saw that utter devastation that it had caused?
Initially, I had heard I was home trying to save my own home, so I wasn't actually down there. I rang a work colleague that lives in the same street with the intention of asking him, could he run down to the cool store and just make sure it was okay, maybe run the forklifts out into a clearer area. He said he couldn't leave his home because the house across the road was on fire and couldn't be saved. So it was all a waiting game. We didn't know if it was rumours or what was going on, what was burning in other places in Harcourt. It was fairly chaotic. When I finally went down there, I couldn't believe how bad it was. It was just completely destroyed. And it was really devastating. I just feel for our customers so much. It's been it's pretty hard to imagine what's going through their minds. They've all got different stories. There's small family businesses. There's old retirees that decided they'd get into wine business. So I'd say to them, why are you still doing this? Why don't you go on a holiday? But they were that passionate about the wine growing and the love of wine making and being in their vineyards. And then we've got bigger growers that make excellent wines, win gold medals, and they've lost a lot. It's just so sad for them. I hope they can get through this, but I know some of them aren't insured. They've lost their whole income, because you don't just sell them the first year. You actually make vintages over the years, and that's virtually your superannuation, your living. They've lost a lot. Some people have lost their winemaking equipment. We can't actually help them at this point. We can't rebuild this in a short time, even for the apple growers, which we start picking gala apples in February. We won't even know if we're going to get paid anything from our insurance by that time, I would assume, but there's just too many unknowns now. But there's a real bad feeling just to look at it. You watch some of our customers walk through the premise, and the look on their faces, it's quite heartbreaking to see.
And Trevor, what's the road back for Harcourt, both from an agricultural sense and a community sense?
Well, the community's been very strong. They've got together and they're feeding people. They're making sure they're getting as much support as possible. It really is a good community here. Although, to be honest with you, I can't go down there at the moment, because to look at friends that are so distraught, it's I can't even talk about it at the moment.
Oh, we're all feeling for them at the moment, aren't we? In Victoria, it's a terrible situation after those fires that have gone through. Trevor Peeler, the manager of the Harcourt Cooperative Cool Stores in central Victoria, and he was telling his story to Angus Verley. 16 to 1. Cattle farmer Theo Lagarde has a property about 150 kilometres east of Harcourt. This is at Longwood East, also in central Victoria. He lost his home in the fire.
Well, I was actually on the fire ground over at Tarkham because the blaze was heading that way and houses were being impacted. The guys had been on the ground for a fair few hours, and I was back at the shed here, so we put the barbecue on, cook some sausages, grabbed a loaf of bread and threw it in the car. We'd take it up there. And while I was up there, they radioed in to say there's going to be a wind change. And I said to the guy that was with me, we better get back to the shed. Came back to the shed, said to the guys at the shed, I'm just going to duck home if it's coming this way to set up at home. So I just live on the Wybie track. I met my daughter halfway down the track and come back and we'll let the cows out and it's heading this way. And so when we got home, she went around and let the cows out and I went and shut all the doors for the sheds. And so we'll go down to the house and grab all the gear that we need to keep, sort of thing. But by the time I got to the house, it was too late. It was chasing us. It had come over the rise and through the Wybie track, and I could see the blades about, I don't know how high, but they were bloody high. And so I said to Kel, just get out. Well, we had to basically go out the back way, cut the fence out the back and go out the back gate, because we couldn't get back down the Wybie track. And the heat was so intense. In my shed, I had so much stuff, but there's nothing, there's not even anything to show that the stuff was there. It's just disappeared as if it's vanished. Wow. I had containers with tyres in it, completely sealed closed for the Land Cruiser that I bought before the tax thing, so I had them sitting in there. And I thought, oh, that'll be all right. Open up. No, there's nothing left. It's gone. As if somebody's taken it away before the fire. It was, I just can't believe how everything is just steel cages, the dog kennels, gone. There's no evidence that they were ever there. So you can imagine how hot that thing was and how fast it was travelling. Because when we left Tarkham, the fire hadn't got this far. But it was outrunning us to get here, obviously.
That's incredible. Do you have anything left?
I walked away with most of what I'm wearing. Well, no, I tell a lie. I'm wearing somebody else's shirt at the moment. I had a pair of pants, my jocks, and CFA uniform.
And that's it?
That and my wife and my two dogs, that's all they got out. I didn't have a chance to go and get my wallet, or any, because that was, I didn't have the wallet in the fire ground because I didn't want to lose it. So all cards and identification, everything, the sort of pack that we had prepared to evacuate, I just, because we were so far away when they changed it, when the wind changed. And the wind changed so many times that day, it was impossible to fight it because we were at the head of the fire and then the wind would change and it throws sparks out another way, and by the time the trucks got there, it's already spread again. We just didn't have enough trucks or cars or helicopters. And you look, it wouldn't have mattered how many trucks you had here.
No.
It wouldn't have... It might have saved a few more homes, but it wouldn't have changed the outcome.
Cattle farmer Theo Lagarde from Central Victoria speaking to the News Channel's Nate Byrne and Emma Rebellato. And as he said, he just can't believe his eyes, that there's just not a trace of anything left behind. Like, as he said, someone just came and took it before the fire actually came through. That's how hot it was burning. 12 minutes to one. Let's jump the border a bit into northwest Queensland now, where the floodwaters are continuing to recede and the damage is becoming much clearer. The Queensland Department of Primary Industries says the number of livestock missing or dead now sits at just over 51,000 head. There are just over 2,000 kilometres of fencing down and over 3,500 kilometres of private road impacted. Grazier at Argyle Station near Julia Creek, Patrick Hick, says he's expecting a significant number of livestock losses at his property.
The sun is out, so the ground is drying out a bit, which is just letting cattle get up on top of the ground and travel a bit. We're still getting losses from pneumonia. We lost quite a lot of cattle to pneumonia, and that's ongoing, but it's starting to slow down a little bit, but certainly cattle are still very knocked around. We've been spending quite a bit of time up until yesterday just pushing cattle into their watering troughs and making sure they're getting out, getting a feed, getting a drink, which they were sort of not doing for themselves. I guess they were a bit shocked from the event, so we've been doing that, just basic animal husbandry, but it is getting a little bit better every day for us. There are plenty of people still in the on the river proper who are still in the thick of it, and the peak has not passed them yet, and they've got cattle standing around in deep water and trying to keep them alive. So we're past the worst of it, but there are plenty of people who are not. The flood peak is still moving downstream and it's got a long way to go. And so there's, while I'm saying that things are getting better for us, there are other people out there who it's, the worst is yet to hit them.
It is early days and it's hard to predict, but what sort of percentage of cattle loss are you predicting for you guys?
Oh, look, it really is early days, Abby. Until we muster, we're almost guessing. I mean, it's significant, and I can tell from flying around that we're going to be well north of 1,000 head of branded cattle, but other than that, I can't tell you much, really.
How do you think that you and your community are feeling at the moment?
Well, there's probably two things going on there. There's the sort of the shock and grief, the distress of seeing your livestock die around you is extremely hard to go through, and that's sort of, at the moment, that's what most people are going through. They're not thinking about the financial consequences yet. It's just the distress of seeing your livestock die around you. That's the low point. The high point is the amazing job that our community has done, doing what they can to save livestock, and it is so uplifting to see what people have done and the resourcefulness of people. It's quite amazing. We always knew we had a good community, but gee, it is really, the message is really rammed home to us in these sort of events.
Patrick Hick, he's a grazier at Argyle Station near Julia Creek in northwest Queensland, speaking to Abby Holter. 9 minutes to 1. Well, Blaze Aid Australia is calling for volunteers from across the country to help support recovery efforts in fire-affected communities throughout Victoria and also those flooded communities in Queensland. The charity was formed in 2009 after the Black Saturday bushfires, and it supports farmers by rebuilding fences and other essential infrastructure lost in natural disasters. CEO Melissa Jones says the recovery job in Victoria is going to be enormous.
It's absolutely frightening in Victoria at the moment, as far as the extent of damage that's occurred over the last week or so. We really have farmers who have paddocks full of stock, and the ones that haven't been burnt that are starving because they need food and fodder on the ground right now. There are people who have lost their homes and, of course, kilometres and kilometres of fencing gone. So it's really an awful situation. At the moment, we are starting to set up base camps, but a lot of places where the fire-affected regions, they're not yet safe for our volunteers to go into. So behind the scenes, we're working really hard. We've got about 5 or 6 camps that are in line to open as soon as the incident commanders say we're right to go in. We have one camp in Gumalabi, sort of up north of Victoria, sort of sending out teams to properties around Euroa where it has been declared safe, and they're doing some emergency fencing now for containment of stock. We're also organising fodder drops for, you know, farmers who need to feed their animals. But as soon as we open those camps, it's going to be, you know, boots on the ground, and we'll hit the ground running, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Because what exactly, what does Blaze Aid do? What are the services that you're offering?
Well, Blaze Aid started after the Black Saturday fires in Victoria back in 2009, and our primary focus is to help with clearing and rebuilding of fences for primary farmers. What we do is we organise teams of volunteers out of base camps where the volunteers come, bring their vans, and they stay on site. Blaze Aid feeds the volunteers all their meals and gives PPE, make sure everyone's safe, and then we send these teams out to affected property owners to work together shoulder to shoulder with the farmers to start rebuilding.
How do you go filling those camps, Melissa? Do you have enough people on the books at the moment?
It's a funny thing, you know. I mean, I think emotions are really high at the moment, which is terrific. We sort of take on this philosophy, you know, build it and they will come. And, you know, we've had since 2009, 40,000 volunteers through our doors, and a lot of those volunteers a serial blaze aiders, and they come back year after year and help at different camps because they enjoy the experience so much and want to give back to community. But also I think this time when we have such huge fires, you know, there's an awareness about how people can help and how people can volunteer, and particularly people from, you know, city populated areas, they hear about blaze aid and they want to just to be able to do something. And, you know, with blaze aid, there's a job for everybody in our camps. You know, there's, you know, from cooking to cleaning to admin to tool maintenance and fencing, obviously. So, yeah, there's a job for everyone, and we sort of open the doors and say everyone's welcome.
And it's not just Victorians that are able to come and help with the Victorian bushfires. You're also putting the call out for people from around the country.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, we even have people from overseas who volunteer their time, and there's a whole variety, young people, older people. I think our youngest volunteer was, you know, 6 years old, and eldest is, you know, 94 or something. So that's what's really lovely sometimes about a blaze aid camp is, you know, after the day's done and they've been helping, they sit around, you know, the campfire and share a meal together and talk about where their people of each other are from and yeah, their experiences.
And I would imagine as well, Melissa, when let's just say it is a farmer or a primary producer who has been affected by these fires, a volunteer coming in who may have had a similar experience in the past, it doesn't just offer that, you know, the physical fencing or, you know, helping out. It's actually just having that shared experience.
Yeah, well, you're right, Kate. I mean, that, you know, that cup of tea that you have over smoko with the farmer is just as important as doing the work itself. And I mean, you know, to have somebody who's been through such trauma of a fire or a flood or whatever disaster it might be, and you know, may have spent the last week putting down stock and burying stock, it's a beautiful thing to know that other people care, and particularly strangers. You know, we often get emails saying, I can't believe they've come. I don't even know them, and they're here in my paddock helping me. And honestly, they do bring hope. As we all know, that's the first step in recovery, is that feeling that things will get better.
I just want to move, Melissa, from Victoria over to here in Western Australia, where we've also had huge fire season and it's only the start of January. Blaze Aid has already set up a camp in the southwest of WA in Boddington. How's that going?
Yeah, that's going really well. We've got a small crew there at this stage, and that's just because we can handle that with the location that we've set up there. We're working really hard to try and help those Boddington property owners get back on their feet.
And are more boots on the ground needed for that area?
Look, boots on the ground in that area, not so much. At the moment, we're sort of full there, but, you know, people, volunteers come and go, so there may be a call out. Often we put on our Facebook pages, you know, volunteers needed for a certain area, and at the moment they're right, but it's really Victoria that I think we're going to struggle and we're going to need the volunteers with.
CEO of Blaze Aid, Melissa Jones, speaking to Kate Forrester. If you can help out or you need some information, head to the website and search for Blaze Aid. To Mouche now for the results of today's sheep market. Terry Birkin is here. Hello, Terry. What did you make of the yarding today?
Hi, Belinda. It was a very similar sale to last week, with around the same total and breakup of sheep and lamb supplies. The yarding again consisted of good runs of shorn heavy lambs and larger volumes of feeder and air freight weights down to several lanes of small frame stalls. Mutton supplies were light both in weights and numbers, however pricing improved from the last sale, lifting $10 to $15 a head. Stall lambs recorded gains of $5 to $10, while heavier categories were firm to slightly dearer. Stall weathers also gained $10 to $15 with competition from live shipping amongst the usual regular buyers in the field. Stall lambs gained $5 with light frame stalls starting from $60 to $90 and bigger frame stalls selling up to $198 a head. Light lambs were firm, making $175 to $219, while trade weights were also equal, selling from $190 to $236 a head. Well-presented heavy shorn lambs off feed remained equal and sold from $235 to $290. Storm Merino weather hoggets gain $10 to $15, ranging from $138 to $180, and with more weight, sold to a top of $228 a head. Light supplies of Merino ewe hoggets were selling from $188 to $220, while crossbred hoggets on the heavier side returned $161 to $240, and younger rams sold to a top of $250 a head. The mutton market recovered from last week's dip in values, with bony grades selling from $70 to $181, medium weights from $165 to $221, and heavy ewe sold to a top of $230 a head. Heavy weathers range from $180 to $250, and mature rams sold from $90 to $218 a head. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you so much for that, Terry. Appreciate that, and good to talk to you this afternoon. On the ABC across WA, it's news time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.